Hello and welcome to the new episode of Death and Taxes, a weekly podcast by the private client team at Burgess Salmon. My name is Guy Broadfield and I am a tax and trusts lawyer in the private client team. And together with my tax and trusts colleagues, Tim Williams and Edward Hayes, we will discuss a range of issues facing clients and professionals alike. Each episode, we will be joined by specialist lawyers from around the firm to bring you our views on important topics for private clients. In today's podcast, we'll be talking about what you need to know about divorce, the steps involved, and the points for advisors to consider. And Tim and I are joined by Richard Handel and Hannah Petherick from the firm's family team. Both Richard and Hannah are family lawyers who advise high net worth and ultra high net worth individuals on divorce, with a particular focus on complex financial settlements and asset protection, including advice on the well-known pre- and post-nup agreements. Welcome to this episode of Death and Taxes, and we are going to discuss divorce, and in particular, how the process works and what are the main considerations for clients and advisors alike. And we are joined by our colleagues Richard Handel and Hannah Petherick, who are in our family team. Richard is a director and Hannah is a senior associate, and Tim and I work very closely with them and their colleagues for our clients. Tim and I are advising on the tax side, so specifically looking at issues regarding asset protection and what the tax consequences of divorce might be, and Hannah and Richard advising more on the process of divorce and how negotiations work in that context. And so today the idea of the pod is really to talk about the process and the nuts and bolts of getting divorced, because I mean, Tim and I cover the tax side, but on a day-to-day basis we don't necessarily get involved with the process in much more detail than that. And that's fair to say, isn't it, Tim?
Absolutely right, Guy. I mean, I think yes, we do a lot of work with Richard and Hannah and their colleagues, but what we tend to do is very is kind of specific queries about particular things. So it's a little bit hard for us to get a real overview, I think, of the process of getting divorced. So what I'd like to do is, in the great tradition of questions to family lawyers at presentations, is say, let's say I've got a friend who would like to get divorced. What is the first thing that I need to do to start the process off?
Well, the first thing you need to do is take advice, Tim, because everybody's situation is different. In terms of the divorce itself, at the moment it's a fault-based system, which is based on the irretrievable breakdown of the marriage, which can be proved by five facts, including adultery, unreasonable behaviour, 2 years separation with consent, 5 years separation or desertion, which is not something we ever come across. The divorce itself is primarily a paper-based exercise where one party files a petition, the other acknowledges that petition, and then the court can move on to the decree nisi stage. The harder thing is sorting out how the assets of the parties are divided. There is going to be a change in the law, which will mean that there will no longer need to be any kind of fault-based petition. Isn't that right, Richard?
Yeah, that's right, Hannah. A bill through went Parliament earlier this year, which has brought in no-fault divorce. At the moment, it hasn't yet come into force, but it will do, we think, later next year. And it will mean that parties will no longer have to set out reasons why they want to get divorced. They'll simply say that their marriage has broken down irretrievably, and the divorce will proceed on that basis without having to make any allegations of fault or adultery or having been separated for a certain period.
And that sounds to me to be quite a bold step forward, because I can imagine if you're having to allege on paper that one party's done something to, you know, sufficiently grave to mean that the marriage has broken down, I can't imagine that gets negotiations off on a particularly good footing. So is the aim of the sort of no-fault divorce to try and relieve some of that initial tension?
That's exactly right. So as things currently stand, you, in order to divorce without having to wait a certain period, you would have to make allegations of fault or adultery. And as you say, that can set things off on a difficult footing. It's obviously a very emotional and emotive matter. But hopefully the new no-fault divorce regime will mean that you don't have to make those allegations or deal with aspects of adultery, if that's relevant. So it should make things hopefully easier and a smoother start to the proceedings.
So once you've got things underway, I mean, is the first exercise then to, does the court become involved early on, or is there a sort of exercise that you go through with the with your clients before going anywhere near a court? How does the next stage work?
Yeah, the majority of cases don't need to go anywhere near a court. The first stage is normally for both parties to do some kind of disclosure so that they know what they've got, basically. And most cases come down to an asset schedule on sort of one side of A4. But that process takes quite a long time because often the assets are quite complicated. There's tricky pensions, there's businesses or properties that need to be valued, things like that. So there's a court form E, which is usually used even in voluntary proceedings to undertake that disclosure exercise. And as part of that, it might be necessary to have some valuations, some other expert advice, actuaries involved, that sort of thing, so that you can work out what there actually is. And once you've got that, sort of distilled down into an asset schedule, you can then give more detailed advice about how things might be sorted out. So mostly clients can either discuss things between themselves, they might engage in mediation with a third party mediator to try and reach an overall agreement with advice in the background, or as solicitors, we can do the negotiations either on paper, through roundtable meetings. There's lots of options for sorting things out before you'd ever need to go anywhere near a court. And most people are able to resolve things that way. And we're only required to advise in the background and then document the agreements, which can be quite complicated in a court order.
So you say, Hannah, that most people are able to do their disclosure and make an agreement. I mean, just taking the disclosure point, do people usually do that without too much reluctance, or does that cause a problem ever?
There are obviously always going to be people that don't want to disclose their assets, or who want to try and convince one party that their business is worth absolutely nothing, even though it's been producing a fairly healthy income for a significant part of the marriage. But the majority of people know that there does need to be a disclosure exercise, and usually, you know, that's where we come in terms of, if you get some limited disclosure, you then might need to ask some questions, and it's knowing what to ask depending on the circumstances. You don't necessarily need to see every single minute bit of a PayPal account, but you need to know in big terms what the important issues are and what questions to ask. So that's where we can help people.
And so that disclosure is undertaken by the parties rather than through the courts at that point. So in terms of the steps, you have to issue your petition first off to the court, and then presumably at that point the parties undertake the disclosure, and that it runs outside of the court process really, unless there's an issue regarding disclosure. Is that fair?
Yeah, the financial disclosure process is initially normally voluntary. So the court process, the court divorce, is separate to the finances. If it becomes apparent that for whatever reason, because there's complicated issues, or you want to get a timetable in place, then it's open to either party to issue a financial application at court, which puts in place a timetable within which the finances will be resolved. But that's a separate process to the divorce itself, and they run alongside each other effectively.
And so the disclosure element to that will hopefully clearly identify what each party owns and how much money we're talking about. And then I assume separately to that, there's the question of who gets what. Now, you might, I guess the general layman might think, well, it's probably on a 50-50 basis, the starting point, that is. Is that the case? I mean, what's the framework for negotiation for the parties?
Yeah, that's right. The starting point is an equal division of the assets, so 50-50. But there are some reasons why you may depart from that. So if one party had assets prior to the marriage, then you may be in a position to ring fence some of those or a portion of those, which means they're of the overall assets, there would be an unequal division. You also would look at the needs of the parties. So what each party needs in order to meet their housing needs, i.e. their capital needs, and also their income needs. And if you need to divide the assets in an unequal way in order to allow one party to meet those needs, then that's also a reason why the court might depart from equality.
And I'm thinking about that, Richard. Do something that we hear more and more about in the press, post-nups and pre-nups, do they feed into that division, particularly where, say, there are those inherited assets that you mentioned?
Yes, they would. They are not strictly binding in this country, but if they are done in the correct way, then the court will take prenups and postnups into account. It's one of the factors that the court must have regard to. And that would certainly affect the division of the capital and income, depending on exactly what the terms of the prenup were.
And am I right to say that a prenup can't just say, in my friend's example, my friend gets everything and his partner gets nothing? Presumably there it must be more. Does it need to meet needs, or does it need to be an equal split, or how do they need to be constructed?
So the crucial aspect is that the agreement is fair, and that's what the Supreme Court says from a case called Rademacher and Granatino, which is almost 10 years old now. Exactly what fair means hasn't been defined by the courts, although there is now a body of case law giving better indications. But essentially, it means that each party's basic needs must be catered for. So you would expect a property to be provided to both parties, and then to have sufficient income in order to meet their day-to-day living costs. So that's sort of the bare minimum that you would expect. But obviously, where there are significant assets, it's possible to ring fence a larger portion and still have a capital sum paid to the other party in order to meet needs.
And so use of prenups is particularly relevant where one party has significant inherited wealth, for example, or perhaps bringing more assets to the marriage as a result of a successful commercial venture?
Yep. Very much so. Where there are inherited assets or potential assets which are going to be inherited in the future, that's where they would be used quite often in order to effectively ring fence those assets and perhaps protect wealth of future generations. But also, as you say, where someone's perhaps been very successful previously and they want to ring fence the assets that they've built up during the course of their working life.
And one final question for me. Do we have a concept of sort of matrimonial property in the UK?
No, we don't. So in other or quite a lot of other European countries, they have property regimes, which are usually either a separation regime or a community property regime, effectively either where all the assets are joint assets or all the assets are separate assets. And that dictates how they'll be dealt with in divorce. But in this country, we don't have that concept. And it's very much everything is in the pot, and the court have very wide powers to redistribute assets and a wide discretion as to how they do that.
That's really interesting to hear about the sort of financial side of it. But obviously, another big factor for lots of families in a divorce is going to be children. I mean, how does that part of family life fit into the divorce process?
The arrangements for the children are completely separate. They're often linked for clients because emotionally the money and the children are linked together. But actually the court expects people to try to resolve children's issues between them, because parents are by far and away the best people to make those kind of decisions for their children. And the starting point is that there's a no order principle for children, so the court would not normally make any orders in relation to children unless it's in the children's interests to do so. So that it would be better to have an order than not to have an order. So the starting point is people should try and sort things out themselves, and mediation is a really helpful process for children's arrangements. So the starting point is for us when giving advice is trying to find a way, even with the stress of the divorce, that parents can make arrangements for their children directly.
Yeah, because it's an important part of the process. It's not as, you know, as significant as it is to talk about the financial elements. It's clearly the emotional part to play with children is clearly something that needs to be factored in. Okay, so thanks very much for that whistle-stop tour of the divorce process. And I think Tim and I have certainly got a much better idea of how it all works. I mean, in terms of takeaway points for practitioners and possibly clients alike, I mean, what are your two main points to take away from this very brief summary?
I think the main point to take away is that everybody's situation is different. And if practitioners have got clients potentially that have got issues, it's to pick up the phone and to speak to us at an early stage, whether that's about possible prenuptial agreements, about children's issues, anything like that. If you get advice early, you're going to be better placed in terms of giving your client the right advice, signposting them, than if you wait until things have progressed and they've made decisions and committed to things that they may then regret in the future. So I'd say take advice early, even if that means just a kind of ad hoc phone call. That's a good starting point.
And Richard, do you have any tips for?
I was going to make the same point.
Well, it sounds like that's the key then. The early advice is the
exactly. And also, you know, if you're going to get married and if you've got significant family wealth, as difficult a conversation as it might be, putting in place a prenup or indeed a postnup after the event has to be sort of sensible financial planning for anyone lucky enough to be in that position, as difficult as conversation as that might be.
Yes, I agree that if there is significant family wealth or you've accumulated wealth during the course of your working life, then considering having a prenuptial agreement or certainly taking some advice in relation to it would be a sensible thing to do before you're getting married, and take that advice well in advance so you know you can think about things and what you'd like to do before the marriage. Don't leave it till last minute.
Great, thank you. Well, thank you, Hannah and Richard, for that very informative session, and thank you to Tim for your, from the perspective of a tax and trust lawyer, very very helpful to me and hopefully to others alike. Thank you for listening. And see you again on Death and Taxes next time. Thank you. Thanks again for listening to Death and Taxes, a weekly podcast by the Burgess Salmon private client team. You can find out more about Burgess Salmon and our team at burgess-salmon.com or on our LinkedIn page. Our next episode will cover the proposed reforms to the capital gains tax. So don't forget to subscribe, and thanks again for listening.